Hello, everybody, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. My name is Jamie Kirchick, and I'm writer-at-large at RFERL's headquarters in Prague, and I'll be your host. This week on A Different Beat, RFERL correspondent Ron Sinovitz speaks with Brian Viglione, drummer for the popular U.S. punk cabaret duo The Dresden Dolls, about his role in Afghanistan's first rock festival since 1975.
This is a festival to celebrate self-expression through music and the fact that people are now slightly more able to develop a community based around rock music in Kabul.
We'll also speak to Jonathan Kay, author of a new book about conspiracy theories. A decade after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, he says, they are as popular as ever.
They share the same basic structure, which is that there is some central overarching puppet master that is controlling all world events in secret, that is highly evil, and that is creating wars and depressions and human suffering in general in order to advance some kind of sinister agenda.
And finally, we'll have a conversation with acclaimed Turkish writer Mustafa Akyol. He has a new book out that seeks to reconcile the traditional tenets of the Islamic faith with liberal democracy.
My main focus is whether Muslims can accept the idea of individual liberty and political systems that support individual liberty, like the liberal democracy of the modern world. And my answer is yes.
Musicians in Afghanistan are preparing for the first rock music festival in the country since 1975, a month-long series of underground concerts in Kabul, coordinated with mirror events in Central Asia and New York City. The festival also features internet workshops with Afghan and Central Asian musicians, conducted by Brian Viglione, the drummer for the Boston-based Brechtian punk cabaret duo, The Dresden Dolls. Here's RFERL's Ron Sinovitz with insight on the festival for A Different Beat.
Welcome to A Different Beat. We're speaking with Brian Viglione, drummer for the Dresden Dolls and who's worked in many experimental rock projects ranging from Nine Inch Nails to Gentlemen and Assassins. Brian Viglione is joining us ahead of Central Asian Modern Music Festival, which will feature connections between Western musicians and musicians from Afghanistan and Central Asia. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're a kind of ambassador for this festival. Would you tell me a little bit about that in your own words here?
This is a festival to celebrate self-expression through music and the fact that people are now slightly more able to develop a community based around rock music in Kabul. And so this is bringing together some of the best talent from that region of the world. I was asked if I would want to come and do drum workshops with the artists there who might be curious about careers in music or just my perspectives on playing and collaborating. And I was more than happy to get involved.
I understand that you're going to be setting up these workshops over the internet. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
We're going to basically conduct some discussions via a video Skype group. Things are so under the radar for obvious security reasons and logistic reasons that I haven't gotten loads of detailed information of what date and time and who exactly will be involved. My guess is that there will probably be some kind of like sign-up sheet passed around in Kabul amongst the people who want to attend the festival or get involved in this particular aspect of it. But I'll try to convey as much of my experience to these people who might want to broaden their dreams and their goals and their hopes and what's possible for them.
Brian, I've seen some of your workshops in the past, and I'm familiar with some of your ideas musically. One of the themes I've seen in your presentations is the idea not just of the importance of silence in music, but also a combination of silence and aggression, particularly with percussion. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and how you think these kind of ideas may be welcomed and useful for Afghan musicians or musicians in Central Asia?
Well, yeah, absolutely. word choice is probably very important in this context. The silence and aggression part. For me, as a kid growing up, you know, in a somewhat stressful environment at home and in school, having music as a release, as a real form of catharsis, a way to transform any kind of internal pain into something positive. to mutate something that would normally eat away at you is something that you can express to the world, to other people. And that's something that I would hope to communicate to these musicians as well, is that the deeper you can turn to your own feelings, the way that you see the world through your particular lens, and learn to be sympathetic to the way other people do as well, which is part of collaborating musically and developing a finer, more nuanced relationship with the musicians that you work with. That's also a beautiful metaphor for everyday relationships as well, developing empathy. That's something that I feel is easily developed when you are working with musicians. You're trying to listen to one another, be more sensitive to what the other is playing and feeling and where the music is going to go.
At the same time, these musical workshops, it's a give and take sort of situation.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what expectations do you have about something that they may be able to offer you as a musician?
I would hope rhythmically. One of the surprising things is how similar rock musicians are all across the world. It's one of those languages, I guess, that sort of transcends borders. But I'm sure just probably the ideas that they have about how they would be able to promote and get out. I mean, right now, they're in a very unique position in the world. Most countries, rock and roll has come and gone, and it's not a new concept for a culture or society to digest and cobble. It's very new. They are an extremely small percentage of the populace in Kabul with the daring to go out and use this voice, which is often perceived as very threatening by a majority of the public. So that's something that I'm looking forward to hearing from these people, is the way that they're coping with that and the devices they're using to bring their music out in a way that doesn't seem like any sort of threat, but hopefully as an empowering force in their community.
You have events in New York City at the same time events in Afghanistan. I understand that the New York events are going in a way to try to mimic the kind of underground scenarios where bands would play in Afghanistan.
It will have the sort of the feel of a sort of underground and secret event. That's how things were, I think, anyway, with any sort of underground scene. Certainly the punk scene in the 1970s wasn't welcome in your everyday rock club. It took some time to break into the public, and I think that's what they're trying to set up now for people, which is nice. But obviously, living the real thing is much different, too. And there's a definite element of awareness and safety that's at the forefront of my brain for the musicians in Kabul right now. I'm really wishing everybody a very safe experience over there.
I understand originally you had planned to go to Kabul, but because of safety concerns, you've decided instead to stay away.
I made that decision very regretfully and with a lot of consideration. When the idea was first presented, my instinct was to say, that sounds dangerous. I appreciate the offer, but no thanks. It's also right in the middle of two other recording projects that I've got, and it could be very complicated travel-wise. But after I spoke to one of the other main people in Kabul organizing, I was curious, and I did want to be won over a bit and sort of believe that it would be possible for me to go there. And so I made the travel plans, bought a non-refundable ticket, and was utterly convinced that things would be taken care of. However, things just didn't stack up quite the way I had been hoping in terms of logistics and where I would be staying and any sort of safety. Added to the news headlines and things that I was hearing directly from people there, that it would be an unwise decision, and rather than it be seen in a friendly light, my showing up, it more than likely would be a sort of an antagonistic type of thing. And I didn't want to make myself or anything that I brought to the festival a liability to the experience. I want my involvement to be as positive and additive to the festival experience as possible.
I want to thank you very much for taking the time and a very busy recording schedule to be with us and speak to us here on A Different Beat. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace. Cut out in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried.
Jonathan Kay is a managing editor, columnist, and blogger for Canada's National Post newspaper, and author of Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. He spoke with me earlier this week from Toronto. Can you tell us now, you know, this is the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Would you say that 9/11 conspiracy theories are more or less prevalent than they were in the initial aftermath of the attacks?
It's an interesting question. 9/11 conspiracy theories didn't really peak, I would say, until late 2003 and early 2004. And the reason for that is the Iraq War. A lot of people felt deceived by the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And they started asking themselves, well, you know, what else have we been misled about? And this led to a natural increase in 9/11 conspiracy theories. And I, yeah, so 2004, 2005, 2006 were – there was a lot of conspiracism. The election of Barack Obama in 2008, I'd say, marked the point where the conspiracy theories started to turn downward, because it was – you know, every good conspiracy theory needs a villain. It's kind of like a Hollywood movie. And when you had Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld in the White House, you know, there's – they were kind of natural villain figures for conspiracy theorists. Obama didn't fit the mold as well. And so since 2009, you've seen, I'd say, a downward trend in 9/11 conspiracy theories. At the same time, conspiracy theorists have shifted to other conspiracy theories, like financial conspiracy theories about the Federal Reserve and so forth. And of course, you have birther conspiracy theories about Barack Obama's birthplace.
Is there an element of truth in any of these conspiracy theories? I mean, let's take the 9/11 conspiracy theory. Is there anything that these people say that is in some small sense accurate?
Many things they say are accurate. You know, if you interview conspiracy theorists, they will often point you to a lot of highly accurate information. They will, in some cases, cite mainstream news articles. They will talk about, in the case of 9/11, they'll talk about the project for the new American century. Back more than a decade ago, where right-wing Americans were looking to reshape the world, to make it a safer place. The problem is how they stitch these things together. You know, it's one thing to say accurately that the Americans did want to get rid of Saddam Hussein. You know, regime change in Iraq was the foreign policy of the United States going back to the Clinton era. That's true. It's another thing to then say, well, of course, they then mass murdered thousands of Americans as a pretext to go attack Iraq. So all conspiracy theories, with some few exceptions, have little tiny grains of truth at the base of them. What then happens is those grains of truth are expanded in an obscene way to create Hollywood-style fantasies about great conspiracies.
You talk in your book about one of the reasons why you think conspiracy theories have prominence in America, or what drives them in America, is a sort of libertarian ideal of individualism, which has been supposedly perverted over a history of 250 years and increasing government control and mechanization and whatnot. How does that differ from the sort of environments that give rise to conspiracy theories in other cultures?
Sure. You know, as you say, in the United States, one of the sources of conspiracy theories, especially on the right, is this comparison of the world that the founders lived in, you know, the 18th century, with the world we live in today. And it's true that, you know, as a result of industrialization and higher population density and urbanization and security threats and all that sort of thing, the government has just by necessity become a greater presence in our life. And libertarians in particular look at that and they say this is part of a conspiracy to take away our freedoms. There is no comparable trend in Europe. I mean, in Europe, which has more of a feudal history, it's simply taken for granted that some central authority is going to take care of things for a lot of people. So there's that huge political culture gap between the two societies, which makes conspiracies about big government just much more popular in the United States. In other countries, especially in the developing world, there's a much different narrative for conspiracy theories, which grows out of colonialism. Take a place like Iran, for instance. In Iran, there is a very real history of the CIA and the British engineering real conspiracies in the 1950s to change Iran's government around. And many African countries also, and in Latin America, you have a colonial history where American corporations and politicians and spies really did conspire with, you know, local warlords and such to change governments and take away people's freedoms. And modern conspiracies is an outgrowth of that. In some ways, I have more sympathy for conspiracy theorists in developing countries where they have that history than in a place like the United States, which is an open society, and it's much less credible, these conspiracy theories.
And so what's the danger of this in terms of conspiracy theories? I mean, they're obviously fun for us to kind of laugh at and make fun of these people, but do they represent a threat to, you know, liberal discourse society?
Sure, and you're already seeing this in the United States. You know, I ask people, how can you have a legitimate conversation about foreign policy and domestic security if you think 9/11 was an inside job hatched by the U.S. government? How can you have a legitimate discussion about healthcare if you think that Barack Obama's healthcare plan was just a big conspiracy to send your grandmother in front of a so-called death panel? If you think that Barack Obama is an illegal alien who's trying to secretly institute some kind of communist Afrocentric Sharia plot in the United States, people who believe these conspiracy theories have basically opted out of reality. They live in an alternative universe, and they're not necessarily dangerous to the United States in that they're going to create some kind of violent revolution. But they're dangerous in the sense that they have eroded the marketplace of ideas to the point that there are just millions of people you can't have a sensible conversation with. And that is a danger to democracy. Democracy requires a well-informed citizenry, people who vote on real issues, people who educate themselves on real issues, and people who you can talk to and you can create a political consensus. The United States is rapidly becoming a place where you can't create a political consensus because people have become radicalized by conspiracy theories.
And so is there a solution to this, or is it just going to get worse with the proliferation of media sources and, you know, popularity of the internet and whatnot?
It's very difficult to rescue someone, if I may use that verb, once they've become a conspiracy theorist. They become immune to rational argumentation. My project in my book was to educate people who are not conspiracy theorists and to show them the basic structure of conspiracy theories so that they recognize them, so that when their brother-in-law sends them the email about Barack Obama or 9/11 or the latest plane crash or, you know, how the U.S. military caused the latest earthquake, they will recognize the structure and claims that have been contained in conspiracy theories for centuries. And they will see that structure and compare it to the information or purported information they're getting and be able to say, hey, this is bunk, and arm themselves with the mental tools required to know when something looks like conspiracist nonsense or when it might be legitimate.
Jonathan Kay, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jonathan Kay, author of Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. You can visit Kay's website at amongthetruthers.com and listen to my full interview with him at my blog, At Large, on referl.org.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very easy. Drop us a line at podcasts@rfrl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
He's been hailed by many in the West as the voice of a new moderate Islam. Now, Mustafa Akyol, a Turkish writer and religious thinker, has published a new book called Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty. RFERL correspondent Robert Tate spoke to Akyol, who says his book seeks to reconcile the traditional tenets of the Islamic faith with liberal democracy.
Is it possible for a good, devout Muslim to accept and embrace the modern secular state?
I think so, yes. I mean, in my book, Islam Without Extremes, I deal with the issue of terrorism and violence actually in a limited way. My main focus is whether Muslims can accept the idea of individual liberty and political systems that support individual liberty, like the liberal democracy of the modern world. And my answer is yes, because I mean, there are different, of course, opinions about this. But when you look at Islamic tradition, and when you look at opinion makers in the Islamic world since the time of Prophet Muhammad to today, you can find references which would say Islam doesn't define a state. Islam defines an individual. Islam defines a community. It promotes a more pious individual and a pious community. But it doesn't define a particular system of government. Of course, states that, you know, that take Islam as their religion existed throughout history, but this was just a historical phenomenon. It was not what the religion condoned. The institution of the caliphate, for example, many Muslims think that the caliphate is an injunction of Islam as a religion, but actually it's not in the Quran, and it is just an idea that Muslims had after the death of Prophet Muhammad. They said, what are we going to do? They established this institution. It was a human decision. So my argument in the book is that there is no such thing as an Islamic form of government, and Muslims can accept different forms of government according to their time and milieu. No wonder medieval Muslims accepted monarchies, sultanates like the Ottoman sultanate, and tried to look at it with Islamic terms. And in the modern age, Muslims can accept democratic republics and live as faithful Muslims under these secular systems. Of course, we should make a distinction between a secular and a secularist state, as I say in my book. In other words, a secularist state would be a state which bans religious practices. Of course, that's not compatible with Islam or, I think, any religion. But I think a secular government which respects religious freedom, which allows individuals and communities to live according to their faith in full, I think would be compatible with Islam.
What are the experiences in your own life? Are there any such experiences that have driven you to try and resolve this apparent conflict or dichotomy between Islam and individual liberty?
Well, in my book, Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty, in the introduction chapter, I actually explain how my own experience with Islamic sources led me question to some of the authoritarian elements within Islamic tradition. I tell this story of my grandfather. I had a grandfather who was very pious, and he taught me a lot about religion when I was a little kid. He taught me how to pray and recite the Quran. In his library one day, I found a book which said, if your children do not start to pray at the age of 10, then beat them up. And that was shocking for me. I knew that my grandfather would never do something like that. But that, you know, injunction in this religious book really made me disturbed. And I had asked about this to my grandfather, and he, in return, explained that, you know, it's only for bad kids and so on. But from that particular moment, I had this question. The question was, what is good with religious practice if it is imposed on you? What is the meaning of prayer if you do the prayer because you fear from oppression? What is the value of going to a mosque if you go to a mosque because the religious police sends you to the mosque? And I think I've always had the conviction that religion should be something which comes from the dictates of your own conscience and not the society, let alone the state. And with this conviction, I looked at Islamic tradition when I'm doing the research for my book. I noticed that many of the authoritarian elements in Islamic tradition, like imposing prayers, imposing piety, or banning apostasy, or banning particular sins, come not from the Quran, the very divine source of Islam, but from various interpretations of the Quran or later traditions that Muslims of the Middle Ages built up according to their own mindset in that time and milieu. And I think now that it's time to question these things, because we live in a free world, and Islam—it is unjust to Islam to depict it as a authoritarian, oppressive religion.
And that's all the time we have for this week. To close this edition of The Blender, we leave you with music by the Dresden Dolls, featuring this week's musical guest Brian Viglione on drums, with Amanda Palmer singing and playing keyboards. Thank you for tuning in, and until next week, this is Jamie Kirchick saying so long.
Imagine any flesh and blood could be his match. with girls, but I know he feels like a boy should feel. Isn't that the point? That is why I want a coin operated boy with a pretty coin operated voice, saying that he loves me, that he's thinking of me, straight and to the point. That is why I want a coin operated boy.